Welcome to The Squid of Despair, unscripted musings on business life, leadership, creativity, transformation, and all the myriad of other work-life events that get in the way of a good night's sleep. Hosted by David Ayling Smith and Peter Taylor.
Hello, Peter.
Hello, Des. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you, Peter. It seems a long time since we've done this.
It is. We all went away and had a bit of a break over the holiday season, didn't we? And now we've finally got around to squidding again.
Yeah, well, I appreciate your sort of end of year summaries and that piece you put on LinkedIn. So is that right? Did I remember correctly that we have squidded in over 100 countries now?
Yes. Yeah, it's like, you know, one person in each country probably. But, you know, either that or our devoted listener has been doing a lot of traveling.
Well, and it's my turn today, isn't it, to come up with the topic?
It is. I live in trepidation of what it is you're going to throw at me. And I'm going to get my Googling ready.
Well, I'd like to link, actually, that comment I just made about our audience being global.
Okay.
And do you want to ask the question, Peter?
I think I should. What is the squid of the day?
Well, Peter, today I'd like to talk to you about global thinking.
Oh, okay.
Possibilities and pitfalls.
That sounds like a big brain thing, that does.
Well, that's right. And let me just perhaps define global thinking a little bit more in terms of what I mean by that. So, yeah, we work for a global organization and we have throughout our careers. And I think there are the massive possibilities with that type of construct. And so that's what I'm talking about here. I'm talking about global organizations and the possibilities that brings, but some of the challenges that brings. I'm not specifically talking about the phrase global thinking to represent a strategic way of looking at the world, because I think that's also a phrase, isn't it, that is sometimes used to describe a particular sort of philosophy, a particular way of dealing with life. I'm talking particularly here about organizational global thinking, and I'd like to discuss with you, Peter, whether you think it has like to discuss the good components of it and some of the challenges of it, if that's okay.
Yeah, very good. All right. That's an excellent topic. Very good. All right. So global thing. You're right, because we've worked for a number of organizations. We've worked for German companies that tried to be global. We've worked for American companies that tried to be global, Canadian companies that tried to be global. I even worked for an English company that attempted to be global as well. So
it's funny, isn't it, that English companies, I've also worked for an English company that tried to be global, and I don't think they're as good at it as American or Canadian companies. Why is that, do you think?
I don't know why they. Is it big thinking? Is it confidence? I don't know.
I mean, if you look at the global software world, I'll make a guess here, and I'm sure our listeners will correct me because I will be wrong, but what would you say? 70% of the software companies in the world are based in North America, as a guess?
As a wild and random guess with no basis on anything whatsoever, that's probably closely accurate.
Yes.
I think we're quite strong in the gaming world, right, from England, personally. But
yeah.
I think in our world, no, definitely not.
Well, and maybe perhaps I can elaborate a bit about, you know, perhaps chuck a few definitions in to sort of get us going, really. So but when I talk about, you know, global thinking, I'm really reflecting on organizations working at a global scale. So mm-hmm. that's what I've been thinking
absolutely
about.
Absolutely.
You know, I'd like to broaden it slightly, because I think, you know, we're in the technology sector, but I think this is true of commercial organizations generally, you know, political organizations. And in fact, I think scientific organizations are very good at this. I think collaboration internationally within the science community is extremely strong. Mm. And so it's, you know, broadly speaking, I would say it's, you know, the macro level, it's a sort of a convergence of economic and cultural systems, isn't it? You know, it's about increased integration, increased interaction, increased interdependencies. It's about, you know, the whole being better than the parts as a principle, I suppose. And yet, you know, if you think about globalization as a phrase, that's got quite a bad rap, hasn't it? It's often a word that's been associated with some of the excesses of of global organisations. So we should explore that as well.
You're throwing a lot at me, Daz. You really are.
I'm just trying to get you, buying you a bit of time, Peter.
Well, I always go and find the fun bit in it. And a great example, and I won't name the company, but we both worked there, was Way Company, that part of their global strategy was to launch a communication model kind of like internal social connection media, that kind of stuff. And you had to do a simple registration for it. And the registration went along the lines of, you know, your name. That's okay, nice and easy. And then it went on to your location. Under the location, you had to put your zip code in. And that's the only thing it would accept.
Yeah.
And that's immediately like, well, that's not very far sort. You know, the people behind it were not thinking globally.
Yeah, rookie error, that one, wasn't it? But how many times, and I'm not referring particularly to the conference we were at recently, but how many times have you been to conferences for a global company and you know the takeaways you get, which you so love, and they turn out to be North American plugs?
That's a point, though. And I will come back to some more sensible thing, but it's a challenge, though. And we're probably just as bad at it as well, because again, you know, at conferences and events like that, or when they're talking about something, often they go down the sport analogy. Yeah. And sport is, you know, it's really difficult to be global when it comes to sport, isn't it? Because we might bang on about cricket, which is bewildering to the Americans. The Americans might talk about football, which is not what we talk about, or baseball or something, or celebrate a basketball star that we've never heard of. And it's a challenge, because to a massive part of the audience, it's totally relevant.
But
to anybody not from that country, it's often irrelevant.
That's right. It's one of the challenges, I think, associated with being global, about your terminology and use of language. And you know, what do you mean by global? Look at the World Series in the US in terms of a sports.
We're quietly chuckled to ourselves about the phrase World Series, weren't we?
Yeah, right. But no, can I lift us up again, Peter? You've gone down the rabbit hole.
Because you lift me up, you know that.
That's a good song. So can I just posit some, you know, macro level positive components of global thinking or global organizational possibilities?
I feel you've done your homework this time around, so I feel I have to give you the platforms, I guess.
One of us have had to do some work, Peter. So I would say it's, you know, so one of the key components of the success of global organizations is to do with growth, isn't it? It's about expanding its market or expanding its trade. I mean, that's one of the big drivers for being global, isn't it? Of course, for commercial organizations. I think there's an aspiration to drive innovation by promoting exchange of ideas. That's certainly true in the scientific community, as I was explaining before, which is why, you know, when the UK left the European community, there was so much fuss, because there was an excellent scientific exchange program called Erasmus, where scientists would collaborate, you know, ignoring country boundaries, because they were all focused on the same topic. And that all got canned because of money. And so you can see how, at its best, large organizations, large conglomerations of groups have the possibility of exchanging ideas, which I think is potentially the fuel to innovation. And actually, I'm going to come back to this, because I think also there's a problem with global organizations stifling innovation. But anyway, I think the theory is that it promotes innovation.
Mm-hmm.
I think, you know, sort of politically, when you talk about this, and I'm not making a political statement here, but it's about removing barriers, isn't it? About removing political or economic barriers. And I think sometimes within organizations, the principle is about removing barriers to growing by streamlining systems and processes and standardizing on systems. So I think there's something about infrastructure in global companies which is intended to facilitate growth. Would you agree with these so far?
I would do. I think what you're saying is absolutely correct. And maybe if I go back to the scientific community, is it a matter of maturity in history, because they've been doing this for so long? They were doing it in a non-digital world for a long time, and they moved into the digital world. And in fact, you know, isn't that the source of the grand old internet, it was to help that community?
You, as always, have spoiled my punchline, Peter, or read my mind, whichever way you want to look at it. Because I was going to go there actually, because I don't really think it's you. I mean, I think if you, do you remember that wonderful Monty Python sketch? What have the Romans ever done for us?
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely, yes.
Where you know, for those of you that don't know it, it's where you've got a series of ancient Britons having just been invaded by the Romans. So we're talking two centuries ago now, debating, you know, how bad it was to be an occupied nation. And their leader says, well, what have the Romans ever done for us? And someone puts up their hands rather sheepishly and says, sanitation? Oh, that's right. Yeah, it was really bad before they came. Yeah, but apart from sanitation, well, roads? Well, that's true. Yeah, before they came, we just had muddy ditches. Well, apart from sanitation and roads, well, the amphitheater, that's quite good. But, you know, what don't see. So it was a wonderful, very funny list of all the things that the Romans had brought to the ancient Britons. And so, you know, that was a very early example of globalization bringing benefits to an impoverished region, don't you think?
It was, absolutely. I do. I think so. And this is where I can plug my existence as a speaker at this point as well, because, you know, regarding the scientific community, I was fortunate enough, literally just before the great pandemic, I presented at CERN in Switzerland, which was, you know, very odd, very exciting for me. But what I reflected on while I was there, it was the most multicultural group of people. Very, it felt to me a very sort of, you know, open, honest community, talking to each other, sharing knowledge, etc. Something that you know, we typically don't come across.
It's so interesting, that, isn't it? That what is it about the scientific community when it works well is so empowering, you know, compared to perhaps the commercial world where it's perhaps a little more closed. Mm. Is it something to do with sort of the purity of the search for knowledge? And needing to collaborate because everyone's such a specialist.
Yeah, I was going to go down the route of kind of respect. I think is perhaps the starting point there. When these people get together, they have respect, they have reputation, they have a degree of authority, but they're also exploring. And I think if I get to the kind of perhaps the heart, and I'm trying not to spoil any of your brilliant summations or anything like that, but you know, the thing that I think we've all seen is when it goes wrong, it's due to typically lack of understanding of the cultures of other countries, the language of other countries, the kind of time constraints of other countries, etc. You know, I think there's some great stories in there about from the marketing world where they've launched something and it means something completely different in a country. It's often quite rude.
Hold on to that thought because I want to stay with the positives for a moment, if I may.
Okay,
because I agree with you, and I think there's a rich vein of humor we can mine with the things that have gone wrong because of cultural misunderstanding. But going back to that sort of historical note with the Romans, you know, I think it's proceeded at a pace since then. If you think about, you know, the Silk Road, the East India Company, you know, those very early trading networks that actually caused an expansion, a proliferation, a sharing of ideas, I think was early indicators of globalization. And after, you know, after World War II, if you look at I'm not an expert of modern history, but if you think about, you know, the organizations that came out in that period, you know, United Nations, the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, the EEC, you know, they all came out of that terrible period in Europe's history or the world's history, mm-hmm. with a wish to sort of make better communities. And that sort of philosophy that you never really solve the big problems on your own, do you? The really, really big problems. You know, you think about the big challenges on the table today, like global warming, you know, international crime, pandemics. You don't solve them by slicing them down, I don't think. I think it's about coming together to solve them, which I think is what that big push was after World War II.
Yeah, you could be right there. That's an interesting reflection, I would say.
But then we get the internet, don't we? And I think then that really, that, you know, the internet enabled just an explosion of communication, you know, the mobile telecoms revolution, transportation, all of that, I think, fueled what has become a very sort of global economy. And I wonder whether that's, you know, just starting to veer towards, you know, what's wrong with it, whether that's where some of the negativity came from, because you look at some of the expansion of global companies like McDonald's, for example, and Amazon, other global brands that you can imagine, many of which have got a bad reputation for reasons that, I'm not sure they deserve, actually. I don't know whether what your view is on global organizations, Peter.
Well, the point I was going to make about it, and I think McDonald's is a really interesting one, because if you travel and you do end up in McDonald's in various parts of the country, which sometimes you do after a good night out, not all McDonald's are equal. So when they talk about globalization, the brand is globalized in the sense that it is McDonald's. There are variances of color schemes. There are variances in format and structure. There's definitely variances if you've ever watched Pulp Fiction with the menu, for example, with a Royale, etc. So they've globalized, but it's not been the one model that is thrown out around the world.
Yeah, and I think they, I think that's probably where we should take this, which is, I had a salad once in McDonald's in Paris, and never been able to have one since in McDonald's. not I go there very often, but it's something about taking the benefits of the global standards, isn't it? But applying the local requirements on top of that to get the best of both worlds.
Absolutely, I had a glass of wine in a Starbucks in Holland.
Well, that doesn't surprise me, Peter.
They asked me to leave with my bottle, but you could. Yes, it was like in the evening, it turned into kind of a wine bar. It was very interesting, experiential kind of model. But yeah,
I wonder generically whether, we're talking about global organizations and some of the benefits of global organizations, but I wonder, within our world, there's a big sort of philosophy around centralization and decentralization in politics as well, isn't it? In government, in particular. I wonder whether it's the same thing, whether you often see organizations flip-flopping between being very centralized mm-hmm. and having command and control structures in the middle, and then the decentralized parts are the recipients of the work of the central body. And then, there's a bit of a revolt. The central body doesn't reflect the local requirements. And so it flips to a more locally governed or locally managed, more autonomous entity out in the regions, in the geographies, perhaps. And then over time, that gets too expensive and it flips back again. They're sort of 5-year cycles, aren't they? Particularly in the technology world.
Yeah. It's fascinating. I think you picked a good one here, really, because, reflecting from my own point of view, running global PMOs and thinking about the world, I'm always, always have to be conscious of those the parameters of engaging in time with people around the world, obviously, understanding to a degree their kind of culture and their sort of language constraints as well. And I think there is the respect of local calendars and events and things like that. There's a lot of dimensions to, if you like, not just thinking globally, but acting globally as well. Maybe you didn't want to go there, but that's the things I've always thought I had to think about.
Well, I did want to go there actually, but I was going to use that phrase, which I think is in more common parlance, which is think global, act local.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Is often used to describe trying to get the best of both worlds. It's often used actually with the big problems, isn't it? You hear it today with efforts to tackle climate change symptoms, where such a big challenge for the world, and yet as individuals we all come to terms with what we can or can't do, and so you sort of see that phrase acting out in big issues like that. But I think you've just been talking about the way in which corporations try and juggle that reality of wanting to bring all the benefits of globalization, or perhaps standardization is perhaps a more generic way to say it. So you've got that centralized control, you've got the buying power, perhaps you've got the risk management facilities, perhaps you've got the reduced cost availability of bringing in global workforces.
Mm-hmm.
You've got an improved quality through that sort of focus. Perhaps you've got innovation through exposure to all these new concepts. So you're trying to bring all those benefits to bear. But why don't we then go there, Peter? Why don't we go to where you were heading with this? What's the problems with it? You talked about some of the tactical operational problems in terms of culture and timing and language and some of the hilarious mistakes that we've seen in our career where people have used completely the wrong naming conventions for their new products, which is quite fun.
Yes. Yeah. Well, I've used completely the wrong name for someone once because of the local structural format of, you know, first name, second name, or vice versa. So, yeah, it can be very confusing with lack of knowledge of what a name format looks like.
Yeah. Well, some of the naming conventions for some of the sort of global programs that we've been part of, actually both of the ones that I can think of now, which are funny, are both rude. And so I'm not sure I can repeat them. The one that I do remember is many, many years ago, where there was a car that was produced in the UK that the makers wanted to take to Germany. Do you remember the Triumph Acclaim? Well, a very old fashioned car that was made in the UK. And it couldn't get taken to Germany because Triumph Acclaim apparently translates to Zeke Heil, which was not thought to be a good name for a car.
Goodness me. Well, I was going to come up with a Renault Fuego, which would be something very rude in Spanish, apparently. So I'm not explaining what it is. People are just going to look it up. It's less offensive than the example you gave, in the sense.
Yes, sorry about that.
No, it's fine.
Starting low. Well, like the North American car, the Probe, you know, that had to change the name quite quickly in the UK because it offended lots of people.
Yes.
But no, seriously, I mean, what are what are the pitfalls, do you think? You know, we've lived in this world for a while. Have we got any listeners who are part of a global organization? You know, what are the sort of things that we trip over, do you think, as part of a global organization?
We're now speaking to our listeners in 106 countries. So
exactly. Yeah. Did you see what I did there?
Yeah, love it. Love it. You're very clever, aren't you?
let me posit some, see what you think. You know, I think one of the things that's irritating for the recipients of sort of global oversight is sort of imposition of what I would describe as foreign concepts.
Yes, yes.
Now, you've got to be careful with this one because often it's a best practice that, you know, when you have standardized approaches being applied like this, sometimes it's a maturity model problem. You know, we've talked about maturity models in the past where you're on a curve towards excellence. And actually, your requirement in a particular place is different from your requirement in a different place because of your maturity. Mm-hmm. And therefore, sometimes what happens in a very well-meaning way is that systems, processes, rules, compensation plans, guidance comes out in a well-meaning way, but it doesn't land well because it doesn't fit the culture, the maturity level. And it's irritating to be on the receiving end of that, isn't it? It either feels patronizing or it feels, what does it feel like? It feels that people are being blind to the nuances of the local requirements, which is, yes. You know, no one likes to be overlooked in that way, do they?
No, they don't. They don't. I'm just smiling because, I mean, we've been to so many sales events where the reward is something that is wonderful for a massive group of that audience, but it's actually a pain to get to for anybody who doesn't actually live in North America, for example. So, you know, kind of global thinking on that.
Yeah. Yeah. Although these are hard problems to solve, aren't they?
They are hard problems to solve, absolutely.
Global organizations, by definition, have a global footprint in terms of their geographic coverage. And we know we've all got very expert at working online, but there is nothing to be coming together. And so you've actually got to choose a location, haven't you, to do that?
Absolutely. Yeah. And you have to go, you have to do the maths, as the Americans love to say.
Well, I remember in a previous organization where you found a very neat algorithm where I was always suspicious of this, Peter, where you basically had global teams and you would key in everyone's address. And it would come up with an ideal location for them to meet, minimizing the air miles. And I always remember that it always came up with a location that you wanted to visit.
We hard coded Hawaii into that. logically, it still hasn't happened. But you know, I don't know if it's out there. I mean, I think it would be a brilliant piece of technology if it really did actually work, is you just, you know, you put all your people in and it looks at all the airlines and the travel costs, etc., and hotel costs, and it came up with, I think that'd be a real winner for companies, but it doesn't really exist. So what they naturally do is go, where are most of our people, what's the minimum trouble they have to do, we deal with the rest. And I think that's probably the one of the problems with this kind of global thinking and global acting is the fact that it is done in that way. It's like, well, let's deal with the majority and then, you know, that other lot, you know, those few folks from coming in from, you know, EMEA or Asia Pacific or whatever, well, it doesn't really matter. They have to travel an extra 5 days or whatever.
Yeah. Can I make a link here between this and DE&I? You know, we've talked before about the importance of diversity within teams and within organizations. Yep. This is sort of the same thing, isn't it? That actually, if a global organization is respectful of the differences that exist in other parts of its world, whether it's, you know, cultural differences, whether it's, you know, the source of ideas, whether it's language, isn't this about tolerance, respect, and valuing diversity? Isn't it all part and parcel of the same thing?
Yes, I think it is. I mean, yeah, I mean, it's one of those things you assume, and that's the danger. one of the things that we tried to do, you know, recently is create a kind of a reference point for, you know, when we have our people working on global projects or programs, is that there is a reference point that says, if you're working in, in Mauritius, if you're working in Australia, if you're working in Germany, if you're working in, you know, South America, here's some cultural variances and things you should be thinking about. So you don't make that assumption that this kind of one size, one format fits all.
Mm.
It comes back to that kind of where I went with, was it is about understanding and education.
It is. And I think with a sensitive approach with education, I think, you know, organizations can get the best of both worlds, can't they? They can have the power of a large centralized organization, which sort of acts as an accelerant, perhaps, for growth in the other geographies. And the other geographies bring fresh thinking, fresh ideas, innovation to the parent company. And you know, by definition, often growth is higher in the regions, isn't it? Because it's a, you know, it's a, they're often a more startup type situation.
Yeah. So yes.
dealing with the and relaxing perhaps some of the corporate strictures to allow that growth to happen, accepting the fact that the maturity level is different and the cultural mores are different. I think that's where the better global organizations win, don't they? And that's how they ultimately out-compete and gain market share.
Agreed. Can I throw a curveball in here, or a spanner in the works, or something like that? I'm
please
not sure
do.
Where you want to go, but I'm going to take
please,
it there anyway.
Please do.
It's you know, there's one thing about progressive globalization, but we've also experienced that companies often do this through rapid acquisition as well.
Yeah.
Which
yeah.
makes it even harder.
Yeah. Yeah, because that's because, you know, it's from a corporate perspective, to buy market share or technology is a quick way to grow. But actually, you've got a subset of culture there, haven't you? An organization has its own construct, it's had its own belief systems. And so that probably trumps the geographic thing. And, you know, gosh, how many acquisitions have failed because there's a brain drain and the technology doesn't get assimilated just because it's not understood. So yeah, definitely a very positive way to grow organizations, but has to be treated extremely respectfully in order to get the best out of the incumbents, I would say.
I'm sure we can offer up massively, you know, comprehensive solutions here, but it's just a recognition of that is another scale of challenge in the kind of globalization.
Yeah, it is. I mean, when you reflect back, Peter, on our working life together, any sort of memories of best practices, innovations, things that you saw in other countries that you really liked and incorporated into your own practice or incorporated into your own organizations?
Well, two things come to mind. One is humorous, and it's your fault. And the second one is probably a more serious one. So I'll go with the funny one first, quickly. So, for listeners, the reason that Daz got on in life is because he basically recruited me originally to take over one of his projects. And I just remember...
Oh, we're not doing the Sweden story, are we?
We're doing the Sweden story. Well, great big meeting room. The owner of the company is in the room. We're talking about standardization around the world, so effectively their version of globalization. There's a big chart projected on the screen, and I was specifically asked where I thought they were when it came to, like, you know, common standardization around the world. And I got a little carried away, and I grabbed a marker pen and I drew a big X on what I didn't really think about when actually turned out to be the biggest flip sort of projection screen I've ever come across, actually. And as soon as I'd drawn on it, you could see that the whole thing wobbled. And the chairman was very good because he said, Peter, we won't forget that, will we? And so that's the humorous story.
Well, actually that company, which we probably shouldn't name, that gave me also a lot of pleasure because they made lifts, didn't they? And automatic doors and revolving doors. And one memorable occasion, one of these like big revolving doors, like you get in like in hotels where you walk in and it automatically starts. And one memorable occasion, the owner of the company, do you remember, he got stuck in it?
Yeah.
And it failed. And there was quite an embarrassing and quite amusing 20 minutes when the engineers were summoned. It was late at night. The engineers were summoned to get him out.
Yes.
And so there was a quick design meeting the next day. And these revolving doors, this is a useful tip for anyone that gets stuck in these in the future. If you move to the back of them and kick with your heel the back of the door, it opens. And that was known in this particular company as the president's maneuver, which I always thought was rather good. Anyway, sorry, back to you, Peter.
No, I'm going to carry on because I'm going to stay in Scandinavia because, in working with a couple of Swedish organisations, I think they just seem to have a very grown-up approach to this.
Yeah.
And I'm sure it comes down to effectively their lack of business ego. They didn't believe they were necessarily right or had all the right answers, and therefore they were and it's probably a very strong cultural thing as well, but they were just very calm about the way to engage and incorporate other companies or countries around the world. Whereas, we've seen other companies try the kind of top down, this is the way we're going to do it type approach. And that just creates resistance and resentment.
Mm. Yeah, I think the Scandinavians' reputations for teamwork is extremely strong, isn't it, in our world? And I think they get, they benefit from it.
I'm one of the most amazing experiences I had was I ran an exercise, and the exercise is very simple. In a sense, you have to have a ball, and everybody has to touch the ball in a certain sequence, and it's how quickly they can do it, and to kind of give it away, really. In fact, you do it where they're all sitting down to start with, and you throw it to each of them, and it's like, well, how can we speed things up? And eventually they work out that they can stand up and do it faster or throw it harder. Then they work out they can stand in a line, then they work out they can stand in a circle and that kind of thing. But in Sweden,
Peter, what was the point of the exercise apart from playing ball?
The point of exercise was thinking about efficiency.
Oh,
that everybody can work smarter if they just apply their brain to it. So, for those who want to do the exercise, get a squidgy ball. Definitely get a squidgy ball. And you just, if you've got like, say, 10 people in the audience, you throw it to one, they throw it back to you, you throw it to another, and eventually everybody's had it. And then you're telling them they have to remember the sequence. And then you say, that probably took, and you take a guess, like 2 minutes, do it faster. And then typically what they do is they throw it harder at you, which means if someone drops it, which is actually not faster. Then they realize they can get up and move and they get in a line. And then you challenge them again and say, you can do it faster. And then you realize if they stay in a circle, it's much faster. Yeah. And there is actually there's another stage on from that, which actually, with 10 people, you can do it in under 2 seconds if you really work it out. Anyway, that's not the actual story was the fact that in Sweden, in this group, they made a decision how they do it. And half the people stood up to move, to go into that kind of when they're going to move and stand a line. And half of them didn't stand up. And the half that had stood up respectfully sat down again, and they carried on discussing, which I've never seen happen anywhere else. They had to move as one or they didn't move at all.
Very good. Very good. Yeah, when I was thinking about this, the one that came to mind, which is a silly one, really, but do you remember in the old days at ASK, the beer busts?
The what?
Okay, maybe it was just me. So Friday afternoon, American company in the UK, the fridge would get wheeled out and everyone would come out into the coffee area and have a beer and chat about the week.
Oh, so that's just where you went wrong. I never actually made it in on a Friday.
Well, you know what you missed, Peter. And I always appreciated that about just a culture that sort of allowed for that. But of course, then, alcohol was involved and it became something that disappeared really from corporate culture in terms of having alcohol on the premises wasn't deemed to be a good idea. But I like that as that was a sort of a North American habit, as so I was told, which I thought, you know, bringing everyone together for a beer in the office at the end of the week, working week, just to chat through what had happened. I like that as a piece of innovation.
Okay, absolutely. We should get Starbucks in with a wine bar.
There we go. Good thinking.
Yeah.
Oh, I think we've given this a bit of an airing, haven't we, Peter?
Yes, we have. I'm not sure we sold anything for anybody, but we recognise the problem. And I think, you know, I would summarise it. And I know you're going to wrap things up because you like to do things properly. But, you know, it's all about not assuming and understanding the other people involved in this kind of, you know, business equation and trying to understand their cultures and their challenges and their ways of doing things and just being respectful and considerate of it.
Yeah. Yeah, no, well said. I think you've summarised it very well, Peter. So, nothing further to add. Well done.
Oh, I've taken his thunder. He'll sulk after this podcast finishes.
So, right. Looking forward to the next one, Peter. And any advance on the book? Are we getting closer?
Of course, every day we're getting closer. It's just I'm not sure how far off the end is actually on this one. But you know, we'll keep working on it.
Yeah,
working on it. You know, maybe, you know, we've asked beforehand if a publisher joins these podcasts and or someone knows a publisher, they put us in touch.
Yeah, definitely.
Wow. It's got to be worth a bit of fun.
Thank you, Peter. I've enjoyed it.
Thank you, Daz. Bye.
Bye.
You've been listening to an unusual podcast from David Ayling Smith and Peter Taylor. More information can be found at www.squidofdespair.com. Thank you.